Hello, and welcome to the Modern Dog Trainer podcast, hosted by myself, Ines McNeil, founder of themoderndogtrainer.net, where you'll find articles, downloads, courses, and coaching on the best practices for modern pet businesses. Be sure to add this podcast to your favorite listening list on Spotify or iTunes, and join our free discussion group on Facebook called Business Support by the Modern Dog Trainer. Welcome to the Modern Dog Trainer podcast. I'm really excited to get to talk to our guest today. She has stepped up to volunteer to join me on the podcast to talk about some kind of different topics than maybe usual, but I'm really excited to talk about them. So today we have Melissa McHugh McGrath, and I'm going to let her introduce herself so that she can do it justice.
Oh, dear. Hi, I'm Melissa McHugh McGrath. I'm a certified professional dog trainer just outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And I grew up in an accidental dog sledding family in rural Maine. Wow. And now I am the co-training director of the oldest AKC obedience club in the United States, the New England Dog Training Club. I'm the author of Considerations for the City Dog, which I think we're going to be talking about today about like urban and environmental impact on dogs and their families. And I have I started a podcast called Bewilderbeast, which is just where animals intersect at humanity, that is appropriate for all ages. And I think that's about it.
Awesome. Well, that's really good stuff. I guess my question is, how did you get to becoming the co-training director at this AKC Obedience Club? I'm not into like the dog show world, but I have dipped my toes in it a couple of times. So I know it's, you know, it can be challenging. So how did you get into that?
Completely by accident. This entire industry has been totally by accident for me. And one of the questions that I'm frequently asked is like, if you came from rural Maine, like, and you grew up with dogs, like, how could you not see being a dog trainer? And it was because like, we had these huskies, we had a dog sled team, we had 10 dogs, we were out in the middle of nowhere, Maine. Dominance theory was still the dominant narrative at the time. And so I honestly thought I would be going into the horse world. I really wanted to my dad was in the military and he was a police officer. And I really saw the impact of that kind of work on those people in those industries. And I wanted to work with like people who have had PTSD, and using animals, especially horses at the time, was a big thing, to try to help those people. I'd always been interested in the connection between animals and people. And then I went to an equestrian school, because I guess those exist. I stumbled into that outside of Cleveland, Ohio, and ended up getting bucked off a horse 2 months into my journey. Wow. And actually ended up breaking my spine. Oh, wow. I ended up being, I can walk, I'm okay. But at the time it wasn't okay. And then from there, I'm like, well, they hurt a lot when you fall off them, so maybe I shouldn't. So I ended up going for the horses and staying for the psych. So I ended up getting my degree in psychology. But after college, I didn't know what to do. Like, I didn't know if I wanted to teach, or I just felt like animals were like the missing piece, and I couldn't quite find a way to put all of these passions together. I kind of stumbled into dog training, as many of your past guests and most people listening would understand. You get that dog that's, in my case, just that right kind of bitchy, that like you have to like work really hard to try to like focus their energy, or work really hard to make sure that they feel safe and comfortable, and work with the dog that's in front of you. And it kind of throws everything that you knew out the window. So coming from huskies that lived outside, and if you said sit, they would just, if they had middle fingers, you'd see them, to this border collie that I was told was a Dalmatian mix from the shelter, that would herd pine cones and would try to herd ducks. And I was like, this is not a spaniel. and trying to find ways to keep her busy and living in an urban environment. I had moved to Boston. My entire trajectory had changed. I was working in a startup. I was an office manager, and somebody came along, saw me at a disc dogs competition, because that's what I was doing to keep her busy. And they were like, have you ever thought about dog training? I was like, no. Like, do you want a job? I'm like, yes. Like, and I literally just like stumbled into this and just kept stumbling. And the one thing I do say about this obedience club in particular, I do say it's the oldest AKC obedience club in the country. And most people picture like Crufts or Westminster with the dogs like running around in a circle, but that's not us. Like, it's not a confirmation club. It's not the beauty pageant. Although we do have many competitors in that world that go. My Adora Mutt Distracta Hound of unknown background captain goes to our club. And so any dog, rescue, purebred, pedigree, accidental whoops in the backyard, like whatever the case, however you got your dog, we are happy to train them and teach you pet dog skills, but also competition obedience skills with positive reinforcement.
Awesome. That's wonderful. So how did you go from trainer to, you know, training director, and like, what did that process look like for you?
So the New England Dog Training Club is the, I believe it started in 1936 here in the States. And for most of that time, it's been in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And before we started recording, I was describing Cambridge and Somerville as Boston's hat. So like, it's very close to Boston. It's like the next city over. And for that entire time, it has been, at least my understanding, I was not around in 1936. My understanding, it has always been a one night a week club. So instead of a job where like I am employed by this group, it's a bunch of people who just love dogs who show up. So I'm a dog trainer. We have a groomer who comes to teach. We have a faculty member of Curry College that comes to teach. We have other people who have dog training businesses or dog walking businesses or pet care businesses that also have their foot in the training world that have either come up as our interns, and we have an intern program as well, or they are just like, hey, I have something that I would like to, I feel like I could teach this skill, and we'll let them try it, and we hire them. Like, it's a one night a thing. It's a very collaborative group. And in this industry, it can be kind of resource guardy at times, like it can be difficult. But for whatever reason, this group, for as long as I've been at NEDTCs since 2009, I think was the first night that I was asked to participate as a trainer. From there, it's always been like at least 14 people of varying degrees of seniority, and always being supportive of our trainers. So if we have somebody in our community, like we, sadly, because of COVID and things happening around the world right now, we have had our first death in our community, in our dog training community, and it was a student. And watching my trainers and these trainers step up and say, I will just go walk these dogs. We will figure something out. We need to send her a card. We need to do, and like really rally around the family. And that is so important for this kind of club. So it's, I think of it more of a club instead of a training center. We rent a school, like in the before times, we rented a school. In the during times, we've been outside in a field until it got too cold because Boston. So we'll go back in the spring. But so being part of that community and then watching one of the training directors go off to become the exec of IAABC. So she went off leaving a vacancy. One of the senior trainers stepped up and kind of took the role. And then she had some things happen and she started her own business, which was awesome. And then the other training director, Donna, she looked at the duties she was getting. She looked at it and goes, yeah, there's a lot here. And I am stunned that these women before us have done all of this for a one night a week thing. Can we split these duties? And so I stepped up to help her. And so the two of us have been doing training director since 2012. So yeah, and we, like I said, we are a very collaborative group. And because there's so many of us that I can look, if I'm working with a student, I'm like, we're not clicking, but I do know that my colleague, who's also part of this club, you guys would get on like a barn on fire. So like, go hang out. You guys would actually get along great. Or if it's somebody who needs like an easier hand, go see Diane, like, you know, like it. So we try to match our students up also to the trainer that would match their personality really well. Awesome. And like I said, we try not to be very resource guardy about like the clients that we have within our community.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. That's really, really cool. Yeah, I think that is definitely not like the perspective that people have of, you know,
yeah,
the dog show world and clubs and all of that. So that's really good to know that there are clubs out there that are like that. And I think that it is kind of becoming more and more common that they're like that. But
I agree. I'm seeing a lot of positivity in the club instead of like the best in showiness of it. You know what I mean? Like the which I used to say was a documentary instead of a mockumentary, but now it feels like this, seeing people be supportive. And I think that's one of the coolest things about social media and having these groups pop up. Like you've had the Smart Bitches dog trainers on through it, and I've been following them. They're fantastic. There are groups that are just coming together and showing off like awesome trainers that are doing awesome work, and they're saying, hey, look at them instead of look at me.
Yeah.
Which I think is a huge pivot and super great in this community.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So the other topic that I'm really excited to dive into is this topic of navigating kind of city living with dogs, and then also like environment as a consideration and animal placement. So, where would you like to start with those two topics?
Ooh.
They're pretty big.
They are. So I guess we could start with considering the environment as part of, if people are looking to acquire a dog, like generally they would say, oh, I want a big dog or a small dog, or I want this breed, or I want this mix, or I want to go to a shelter and get this energy level. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I feel, at least working in an urban environment and living in a rural one, so like I do have both perspectives.
Yeah.
Although I was much younger, of nowhere, Maine. But the thing that I see over and over and over again is people acquiring dogs, whether purebred or rescue, and that dog is not suited for the environment which they're being placed. Mm-hmm. Like if it's a condo or a high rise, or even in my building, it's a two family building. So like we have neighbors upstairs. It's an old building. So like the heater comes on, it goes kaboom. Like, and our neighbors upstairs, if they have a party or if they have a girlfriend over who's walking in high heels, or the dump truck going by, or school's out for the day, and you've got floods of children walking by 2 feet from our window. For many dogs in urban environments, if they are noise sensitive, they're going to have a much harder time. And I think that needs to be considered in placement of dogs in these environments. Mm-hmm. If it's a dog who's visually set off, or scared of a particular population of people, let's say it's men with hats. Well, if you live in Boston, I think it's required for men to wear baseball hats. I didn't see that on the memo when I moved here, but it does seem to be the thing. But like when you have dogs on sidewalks that are straight lines, or hallways that are straight lines, I think it's important to consider that for dogs, straight lines are the third circle of hell. And so when you're putting these dogs in these environments, like either a condo or a high rise or a sidewalk, and they're straight on to things that make them nervous or scared or concerned, and they can't do that like circle thing that they're supposed to do, and they're coming towards something that they might be unfamiliar with, it can be very stressful for the dog and also for the owner, who's just like, well, I'm just trying to walk to the elevator. Like, come with me, Sparky. And Sparky's like, nope, not cool with this. they can hear so much more than we can, that we can. They can hear what we hear at 20 feet. They can hear it 75 to 80 feet. They can smell 40 feet under your feet. That's four basketball nets stacked on top of each other. So if you're in a high rise, they can smell the unit four floors under you, like what they're having for dinner. There is so much sensory input. And for some more sensitive dogs, that can be so overwhelming and so difficult for those dogs to overcome. And I've had several clients who they have worked so hard, they have done everything right, and their dog really just couldn't make it. So they decide to move to the suburbs or out to the middle of nowhere, and the dog does better. I can't find data on this because it's, you know, it's something we don't really think about when you're trying to home a dog, or if you're purchasing a dog or you're acquiring a dog in some way. You don't really think about how the place that you in really remarkable ways. So like when we got Captain, we had three other dogs in our house before that, and they all had to go back. One was really not okay with the highway. Like if you open our front door, the highway is there. There is an interstate like 100 feet to our right. So we've got intersecting highways. We're in a very quiet-ish neighborhood except for the highway. and being in a city, there are people upstairs. And like I said before, just like walking around, there's a lot of activity. And three of them just couldn't, within a couple of days, it was just like, yeah, this is not going to be a good fit for this poor dog. And it's not that it was a bad dog, or a dog that I couldn't work with as a trainer. But I do also have a small child who had activities and things to do, and we wanted a family pet, which I feel like is the case with a lot of our clients, where they just really want a family pet. They don't want to acquire a dog who needs thousands of dollars in behavioral modification, have to have a conversation about medication to just for the dog to feel safe, or muzzle training because the dog was sold as good with kids but isn't. There are a lot of things that go into matching a dog to a family. And I think the one that is consistently missed.
Awesome.
My cat just made a weird sound. I'm so sorry.
I think you bring up a really interesting point that maybe, I don't know if you were leading in towards, but it's something that I definitely caught on to. And that is, there's a lot of shame in giving up a dog that isn't the right fit for your family. And that's like just around the dog industry, like in general. And I think that that needs to go away. Cause like you mentioned, like there's so many unexpected things that may come up after you bring home the dog that you didn't realize would be an issue. And so maybe normalizing that you may need to bring home a couple of dogs before you find the right fit, like makes sense, right? So how did that,
for you? For us, well, the first one, to be perfectly honest, the first one was, we had lost, my husband and I each had a dog. He had a greyhound, I had a border collie. And they died on the same weekend, 1 year apart. And our daughter had just turned three when my border collie was put down. So we had gone through that year trying for preschool, but then I was starting to get really antsy because dog trainer and I need a dog. Like it just not having a dog was more. So our landlord, we had walked outside and saw him on our way out to go look at this dog that a friend of mine had worked at a shelter and was like, this dog is a special dog. She's going to be amazing for you. And we're like, great. So we go. But on our way out the door, we see him and I'm like, are there any restrictions, size, breed, anything we need to know? Because when you're in this industry, you just get a feeling. He said, no, I trust you. And I bet you can see where this is going. We get there and there's a 75-pound steel blue, a dog that most people qualify as a pit type dog. And we bring her home and she's awesome. Like she's very strong. She had clearly never walked on a no pull harness and she was trying to pull, and I'm trying to walk my daughter in a stroller. So that was a little uneasy. But there was never any perceived danger or anything like that. She was a super wiggly, really sweet dog. 48 hours later, they said that dog has to go. And I knew that dog was code for pit bull. And so I had to bring her back and we had to explain what discrimination was to our three-year-old, had to bring Cinderella back to the shelter. Oh. So that one was a little more heartbreaking. I know she named it Cindy. Oh. The 75-pound bit.
I love it.
Steel blue. She bought it. She's three. She had us purchase her a giant pink flower for the collar, named it Cinderella. That dog is now a service dog for a kid in Massachusetts and goes into schools and is a bomb-proof dog. This dog is amazing. And we could have been mad at that, but we know that's how this goes. Even in a state like Massachusetts, where there are no breed discrimination laws, landlords and home insurances can still discriminate and say no. So we went through that. And then a couple months later, like I mentioned, the dog training club I'm a part of, one of the people there works at a shelter. So it was like, hey, I've got my eye out for you. We found a dog for you. We get down there, we bring the dog back. The dog seemed fine there, but as soon as coming into our house was just not okay with the city noises, was not okay with these other things. So because I had this relationship, I could write a report and say, hey, this is what this dog needs. And then that dog was able to get what it needed, what it really needed. It had separation distress so badly that if I left the house, it would pee and bark and really panic, even if other people were home. Mm. In the home with activities and work, it was not going to work, but I was able to work with the shelter and they found a woman who lived at home, never left, had a wheelchair, and this dog lived the rest of its life living on this woman's lap and was thrilled. Aww. So like being able to like give quantifiable feedback that can help that dog get into the right home is so important. And yeah, it's hard and it sucks when you have to have those conversations and send a dog back.
Yeah.
But ultimately it's, you know, like how many people did you date before you get married? Like there are, when you have these dogs, very rarely, like match.com, it won't work on the first try and it's okay. And I think giving people permission to realize that this is a relationship. And when we're talking about relationship-based training, which I hear a lot on your podcast, and with the circles that I run in, it tends to be more relationship-based. That is part of it too, is making sure that the relationship is going to work. And sure, not everything is going to be perfect. Like my dog lives in a city. Captain, when we finally found him, he was great with dogs. He was great with kids. He loved cats. And by great with kids, I mean, he didn't just tolerate them. Like, all right, there's a kid. Birthday parties were going to be a part of this dog's life. With toddlers, he had to love kids. Yeah. And unfortunately for Captain, he loves kids, but not every kid loves dogs. Well, getting it through to him that like you outweigh these children, buddy. And he's just like, I love kids. And he like knocks them over like bowling.
Yeah.
So being in a city, there's different cultures and different perceptions of dogs. So like mm-hmm. making sure that both the kids and their parents and the dog mm-hmm. all could like coexist in our home back when we could have people in our home.
Yeah.
That was something that I could manage. That was something that was like, this is totally appropriate. I can leash him. I can work with him. I can tell the kids to like go in the other room. Things were great for that. That was manageable. Mm-hmm. Having a dog with separation distress when I have a kid getting ready for preschool was not going to be manageable, but there was a way to help that dog. And right. I think if you can start talking to people about, and I do think that there's a shift. I do see it more on social. There are still very much the people who are like, well, dog is for life. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily. Like your life changes. You are not the same person you were 10 years ago. maybe not. I mean, maybe you are. I don't know. For the most part, we are not the same people we were 10 years ago. And I think that relationship over time, just like any good, solid relationship, you have to look at both parties and do they still fit? And for some dogs, they don't on the first try, but that doesn't mean it's a bad dog. It doesn't mean you're a bad owner. It doesn't mean that you're a failure. It does mean that there's a lot of societal pressure for you to have to hold on and keep working a square peg into a round hole. And that piece of it has to go away.
Yeah. I know that the shelter I grew up kind of volunteering at every weekend, they always called it like forever homes, right? When you adopt an animal, it's called like a forever home. And so, yeah, it starts right there. I think with that kind of,
it does. And even in
expectation,
social, like,
yeah,
I've had clients that have, acquired a dog, known it wasn't going to work. And the only reason they held on to it was because they couldn't tell their friends and family that they failed, that they couldn't face the social pushback, even knowing that their kids were at risk of getting bitten, even knowing that this is a good dog that shouldn't be around children.
Yeah,
I can't tell people that I gave up. And that is so pervasive. And you're right. It starts at forever home. But I think it even goes back further than that. I think it's just something in us that we did this. We got this and now it's forever. Well, nothing's forever.
Yeah, that's true.
Except for those commercials, right? Isn't it? Oh, diamonds are forever. That's what it was. Yeah. Like, there's a commercial about this. What was it? Yeah.
Exactly. So tell us a little bit about your book and like who it's for and how it helps people.
Sure. It's called Considerations for the City Dog. I wrote it in 2015. And the impetus for it, honestly, was it was kind of this idea of the things they don't tell you when you have a dog in the city, like how hard it's going to be and the things that you should at least think about. It's not a training book. Like there are thousands of those on the market by people who are way more qualified than I am, who also have better publishers. But I think having somebody holding your hand and saying, look, before you bring a dog home, are you on the fifth floor or the first floor? If you're on the fifth floor and you have a bull mastiff that you're thinking on bringing into your home, how is potty training going to go? How are you going to get that dog out the door if he has an injury? How are you going to navigate this emergency situations? Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like the off-leash thing, right? If shared space is shared space, because there's very little private space. Like even in our apartment, there are people upstairs and every choice they make affects us down here. If it's auditory, if they're burning dinner, like we sense that too.
Yeah.
So the shared space is also auditory and it's everything. So if you're in a public park and you have your very friendly dog running off leash, despite it being against the rules to do so, but he's so good. He's such a good dog. He's friendly. And then I have my dog who might be stressed or nervous with dogs running up, going to say hi. Those interactions with complete strangers can be stressful on all the humans involved, both of the dogs involved. And everybody watching, because now they're seeing two dogs fight. And if it's somebody who's had a bad experience with a dog, that might solidify their experience in thinking all dogs are bad. Like, so you can't, like the domino effect of what happens between one or two people can be very profound when you're in an urban environment or a more densely populated area where private space is slim to none. And the impact that you could have on a total stranger, unlike in rural America, where you know everyone in your town, for better or for worse, in the city, I might never see that person again, ever. And yet we've had this profound interaction and other people might have witnessed it. So giving people permission to see things from both sides, like, yes, that's a friendly dog and your dog does need exercise and here's one way to do it, but consider this too. And it might be that your very friendly dog just jumped on somebody on their way to a job interview or jumped on somebody who had a very traumatic incident with another dog, or just might've been in a culture where dogs aren't revered in the same way, or might be considered pests. So there are many things that you need to consider that it's not just about you and your dog, that there are other people, but there are also some life hacks too. So there's, like if your dog is staring out the window, well, try window film. Or is your dog setting dogs off when they're walking down the street? Well, put a bundle on their tags so that way it doesn't jangle and set other dogs off to give you a better success rate of walking your dog quietly, helping your neighbors out, how to find, should you go to a daycare? Should you get a dog walker? Like the pros and cons of all of those things. So pretty much it's a roadmap for what you need to have if you're living in a city and all the things that you would need to consider from thinking about getting a dog to when you have to bury that dog at some point. Like you can't just dig a hole in your backyard. You have to make the decision to either cremate by a group or cremate individually. And that if you're not expecting that, if your dog is really sick and you've been thinking about it for a while, you might have some preparation. But if your dog has a horrible accident and you had never even thought about this, and then looking at the vet who's saying, well, would you like a group or a private cremation? And you're like, wait, what?
A group?
Like, when I was a kid, we just dug a hole in the backyard. Group? I have to take them all? Right? So like, if you don't know what to expect or what to ask throughout your entire journey, like it's basically like the sense making Facebook thread of like people telling you good advice, like go to a daycare. Well, should you? Go to this vet. Well, here are some things that you can look for. Should I spay or neuter? Well, talk to this professional. And and in it are also like, do I need a trainer? How do I find a good one? Do I need a behavior consultant? What is that? And how are they different from a trainer? And do I need a behaviorist or a behavioralist? Because some guy at the dog park told me I needed those things. And then kind of walking people through what the intention is of that language and what that language actually means. So it's taking what we professionals talk about over gin and tonics and what the conversations that we're having with our clients and making a bridge between those two things.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. That's really, really needed. So that's awesome. I'm really glad to hear there's a book like that out there.
Especially when conventional wisdom is like, my dog is barking. Oh, you should let him bark it out. Well, you can't do that if your landlord lives upstairs, right? You're going to get evicted. So like it just has a tilt a little bit, like all of the wisdom is going to tell you this, but you just have to look at it a little bit differently because there are other people involved.
Right. Exactly. No, that's wonderful. Okay. So, a couple of questions that I like to ask everybody that comes on the show. What is one tip that you wish you had known when you were starting out?
I love this question. I've actually been thinking about it because I love this podcast. So I kind of knew this was coming. I still don't have a great answer, but I'm going to try. I think it would be forgive yourself. You're going to make mistakes if you are it. And I'm saying this to me, to last week's me, not 15 year ago me, even like just last week. When you are doing this job, you are a front-facing individual to the public in some way. Whether you are working, you could be the biggest introvert in this industry and just take private clients and not have a huge public, but that is your public. If you're working with one family, that is your public. And you might say something that might not be right, or that you think is right, or it might be it might even be right and is perceived wrong. I have put myself out there in different ways where I have said something, or maybe I came on too strong or not strong enough, and have beaten myself up over the information that I put out there. Yes, you need to be responsible for the things you say and do, but you also have to forgive yourself if it isn't received in the intended way. And you can either remedy it or you can try to do better next time. And especially for new trainers who are maybe listening, my favorite thing is having new trainers. We started an intern program at NEDTC and that is my baby. I love taking new trainers. I'm a faculty advisor for Victoria Stilwell. Having new people who want to do this work mm-hmm. is necessary. Yes. And they are, I love dogs. I love people. And their ideas sometimes are the best ideas that I've ever heard. But there's also the enthusiasm and the intention meeting the reality of working with people, and in some cases, very hard conversations to have. Mm-hmm. So there is definitely a case for experience and a case for novelty. And I don't think either is, quote, better than the other. But I do think if I'm talking and working with new trainers specifically, you are going to say the wrong thing because you just came out of a conference and you've gotten all this new language and you're going to try to use it and it's going to fail. And that is okay.
Yes.
You have to laugh at yourself in this industry. You have to like look at, because you're not just working with people, you are working with dogs. And when you're working with both, somebody's going to mess up and it might be you, and that's okay. I think one of my favorites was I had this family in a puppy class, and they used to bring their two kids, two very small children. And it was in a daycare that had these half walls. And I saw the parent. I came in a little bit late, traffic city. So I get in, I don't see the children. I just see the dogs, and they're all playing and everybody's having a great time. And like one of the owners is like, hey, so like Bacchus, that's an interesting name. What does it mean? And like the owners of this other dog were like, oh, it's the god of wine. And like the other owner looks around, does not see the children, and goes, and orgies. And yep, that's the face I made. And then all of a sudden, two little heads pop up from the other side of the wall. They were playing tic-tac-toe. And they're like, mommy, what's an orgy?
Oh my gosh.
And she beautifully went, baby, it's like wine, but different. And they seemed totally satisfied with that answer. The way she rolled with that is an inspiration to us all.
Yeah, like, I love it.
Moms do not get enough support and accolades for when the proverbial S does not hit the fan. And I think dog trainers, when we say something or we look around the room or we say humping and then we turn around and there's a little kid going, what's a hump? And then we either have to explain it or leave that to the parents to explain on the way home. There are times where things are going to feel very uncomfortable. And those are just two silly ones. There are some ones that are way more serious.
Yeah.
But when you're in those circumstances, all you can do is laugh at the situation and forgive yourself and hopefully have a good story to tell at the end.
Yeah. No, I love that. And that's so true. I mean, you're never going to be like, you're never going to, if you're speaking out loud there, at some point you're going to make a mistake in what you were going to say. So, I think that's a really good point. And, it's also not an excuse to not talk or not speak up or not participate in the conversation. Right. So being okay with the understanding that might happen and that it's still worth Correct. It for you to speak up and share your perspective. So, what are some common yeah. mistakes that you see new trainers make, or maybe existing or like, you know, experienced trainers.
Sure. I think the bigger mistakes that I see, and I'm going to say this knowing that I have done this too. So this is certainly not to judge, because I've been in this position very, very publicly. Trying to use the language that we have as dog trainers, that is maybe not owned by dog trainers, with good intentions, words like behaviorist, or behavior expert, or, I recently heard of a case where somebody had used a very clinical term in the medical field to describe a not very clinical term in a dog training thing. And I don't want to use the term because I think it might out this person and I don't want them to feel bad. But using language to try to get across an idea, without bringing in the people who are going to be most impacted by that. What I guess I mean by that is there was this case where I had written this, this piece, trying, it was right after, a very, I'm trying to think of the right word, a dog trainer on TV that I don't agree with, had done something, and all the news outlets were calling him a behaviorist or a behavior expert. And I was looking at that term and I'm like, but that's abusing dogs is not behavior expert. There's no education behind that. There's no accountability behind that. And that really bothered me as a trainer, because I get people calling all the time saying, I need a behaviorist. Right. I need this. And they're using the language that they see out in the public. What I should do as a trainer is understand what that language is that they're using and trying to meet them where they are, but also educate them about what that language is. If I say I'm a behavior expert when I am a dog trainer, I am actually hurting the behavior community. Mm-hmm. When I wrote this piece for a dog training group, it was wildly accepted by the dog training population. But once it got to the behavior population, I felt like a witch on trial. And it was justified. It absolutely was, because I was trying to explain this terminology at the people who really should have ownership over that terminology. Mm-hmm. My intentions were good. My intentions were trying to fix this other problem, but I never invited those people to the table. I never talked to a behavior expert. I never talked to, despite having many friends in the behavior community, never talked to any of them. I just thought, I, Melissa McHugh McGrath, can totally fix this whole thing. I got this. Sit down. And I stepped in it very publicly, and Dr. Suzanne Hetz rightfully took me to task in a very public way. And we had a wonderful conversation. And then between the two of us, we penned a better piece that gave both of our perspectives, me as somebody in an industry that is not regulated, which is why maybe we feel a little bit easier using language like behaviorist or whatever, or behavioralist, which is a political science term. So while those people might be really smart, they might not be able to help you with your chewing schnoodle. But having them be able to say, look, we in our industry as behavior certified applied animal behaviorists, even we don't know what this term means. Some of us don't ever see animals in the home. Some of us are zoologists. Some of us just watch belugas all day. Some of us just collect data, but some of us do go into the home. That they need to be the one to take ownership of that. So when new trainers come in and they're like, I got this. And it's so good to see that that enthusiasm is there and that they really want to help. And it's genuine, but to also give the history behind it and to educate and say, okay, well, here's why that's problematic. I'm not mad at you. But here's a thing that happened, and this is not your case to make. This is up to them, and to let them lead. And even though that language is coming at us and we're trying to meet our clients halfway, which can be hard, having them take the reins on this. And when that is settled and sorted over there, then we can figure out how we can support the use of that language. And that's not just in the behavior community. That's in a lot of communities that we're seeing that have had people who look like me talking at them. And it's time for us to maybe have it or for them. Yeah. And I think listening more, despite me just talking at you for 40 minutes, is maybe the wise thing to do, and to really just take it all in and really truly listen, but don't lose the enthusiasm, because once you lose that and you become jaded, then it's time to bounce. And we don't want to see more dog trainers get burned out. There's so many. Yeah. So we still need that enthusiasm, but we still need accountability. And that just takes time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that I feel like that is something that I've kind of been good at. I honestly, as an immigrant to the U.S., for those of you that don't know, I am French originally, and I don't have an accent because I came to the States when I was 4 years old. So I picked the English up at the right time. But I honestly did not speak. I listened through most of my first, kindergarten year. That allowed me to kind of pick up the language skills, but I've always been a really good listener. Just in any community that I join, I'm there to ask questions and really get to know other people's perspectives. But anyway, so growing up, like I didn't speak until I first spoke, and it was perfect English.
Wow. For some reason.
Yeah. That was a long time ago, but my kindergarten teacher, I guess, was ecstatic that I had spoken, and it happened to, be really good English. So it was really just about stepping into the room and just absorbing the culture, absorbing the language, and listening and listening and listening until I could understand the context of everything right before I spoke up. So I would kind of take that and definitely apply that to any new community that you want to participate in and join, that, everybody does have their own experiences, their own perspectives, their own histories. And it's worth listening to, not just, speaking up about your own, which is absolutely correct. Valuable to share, right? Like that's, you have to share your own at some point, but yeah
there's a time and a place for it. Mm-hmm. And walking in and thinking, I got this, without even, if there was a cane and a stage in the old timey, somebody plucking me off stage, that should have happened. And it didn't until it got way out of control. And that happens. And that's what I mean. But you have to forgive yourself. You're going to step in it. You're going to make mistakes. You might make amazing mistakes and it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
This was years ago and you're talking to me. So my career wasn't over. Not, if you step in something, own it, absolutely own it. But then figure out how to make it better. And sometimes the way to make it better is to just shut up and sit back.
Love it. Okay. Last question here before we wrap up is, if there was one thing you could change or improve in the industry, what would that be?
I think it would be collaboration. Mm. And I'm seeing a lot more of it. And again, I come from a community here that is very helpful and supportive. So I know that is not the norm in that not every dog trainer has that. And I have been very lucky that when I fell into this industry, I fell into this particular piece of it. The collaboration necessary when we are, especially now, when we are looking at the health of the dog, the emotional state of the dog's exercise needs, where the dog is coming from, how that's impacting your environment, or how the environment is impacting the dog, how the family is being impacted by the dog, how the dog is being impacted by the family. You're looking at all of these circles. I think when we are poo-pooing on other, maybe even trainers in your own circle, or not taking the advice of somebody who's an expert or very qualified. Let me say qualified. I think that's a better way to put it. Mm-hmm. Qualified to have harder conversations. So if I, as a trainer, am trying to give work with maybe a rescue group, I can give them my perspective and say, look, when I go into a home and you place a dangerous dog, you're putting me at risk. So what things can I give you from my perspective after this dog is homed to make your placement work better? That collaboration only works if it's heard from the other side too. Mm-hmm. And for them to say, look, but we've got these dogs and we are pretty confident that it's going to work here. It just didn't work this one time, but we'll take the dog back and we'll work to make this better. Really having collaborative ties within a community, not just trainers, not just veterinarians, not just behavior experts, not just rescue groups or breeders. There are great breeders. There are great rescue organizations. There are ethical, dog trainers, and there are fantastic behavior veterinarians. There are great veterinarians who are maybe working towards their behavior certification and big word that they usually get, like the diplomate thing, like the, like a board certification. That's what I was looking for. Oh my God, this is going great. But having all of these communities and listening to what they're all saying, so that way we can help each other. Mm-hmm. If we really want to help the dog, we're not helping the dog if we're fighting with each other or saying, well, I know more than your vet, or I, as a trainer, know more about nutrition than your veterinarian who went to school for 4 years. Mm-hmm. Making sure that we stay in our lane, but we're listening to these other groups and getting this dog into the right hands and this family into these other groups, and truly collaborate to help these dogs be successful. I think that's, I see a lot of it now. Mm-hmm. I would love to see more of it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's awesome. And that's definitely really, really important. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. We could probably talk for a lot longer, but I think we need to wrap up. We might have a part two eventually. Let's see, where can people find your book?
They can find it. Because publishing has kind of tanked a little bit with things. It's now just on Amazon or through Dogwise. So you can get it through Dogwise as well. Yeah. And it's called Considerations for the City Dog. And also my website, melissamcquemcgrath.com. Awesome. Rolls right off the tongue.
we'll put it in the show notes.
there's ways to find it from there too.
Awesome. Awesome. And then
thank you.
I will also include your podcast in the show notes, so it'll be easy to link to. And I'm imagining that you can find that on Spotify and all the normal podcast platforms potentially.
Oh, you can find it anywhere you get podcasts.
Yeah.
Yep. Anywhere you get podcasts, bewilderbeastpod.com.
I love it. Awesome. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much, Melissa. I look forward to sharing this episode with everybody, and it's been a pleasure having you. Thank you for listening to the Modern Dog Trainer podcast. If you'd like to learn more and participate in our wonderful community online on Facebook, please join our Business Support by the Modern Dog Trainer Facebook group, where we have loads of free trainings, freebies, downloads, and wonderful conversations. If you'd like to learn more about working with me, the Modern Dog Trainer Academy is currently open for enrollment. In this program, I help great dog trainers build sustainable and profitable six-figure businesses. If this sounds like a program that you might find interesting, head on over to Facebook and send me a private message with the phrase six-figure trainer, and let's talk about whether this program would make sense for you. And as always, you can find loads of free resources, articles, blogs, handouts, and ebooks on my website at themoderndogtrainer.net. See you in the next episode.